Hello there, welcome to the Oasis, and please take that in any way you wish regarding the Silver Screen podcast. Yes, for this one, we're strapping on our haptic suits and running away into a virtual world where the 80s is ever present in order to escape the dystopian hellscape that is reality, which, not going to lie, is pretty much every weekend in this house. But anyway, as we revisit Steven Spielberg's adaptation of the best-selling Ernest Cline novel Ready Player One, I'm DK, Gunter Extraordinaire, and I'll be taking over for Mike for this one, as it's right in my wheelhouse, and Mike's knackered from a con. But fear not, the man himself is still with us. Fresh from his own trip down Geek Memory Lane, otherwise known as the Northeast Comic Con, he's the H to my Parzival, it's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Hello, yeah, you'll always be my Wonderwall, DK. Hang on, no, not that Oasis, right? Yeah, different Oasis, got you.
How you doing, buddy? How's the con? Recovered yet?
It was very good. I'm still a little bit knackered because it was very busy, very overwhelming. But we've talked about it off air. The highlight of the con for me was Freema Agyeman. And if anybody has my socials, you can see why. She was very friendly.
Oh, she looked like she had a great time in that picture. Yeah.
not as great as Mike was having, no doubt. Nice. We're not alone on this one, as you just heard. So on this quest to make sense of Anorak's Almanac, we're also joined by our very own Daito and Sho. We'll leave it to them to decide which one is which. First up, we've got regular Silver Screen guest who last joined us over on our cult show to shoot the breeze on the animated classic that makes a none-too-subtle Easter egg appearance in this one, Akira. It's Toby.
Hi, I'm nice back, one. And I'm whoever had that Gundam mech.
We knew you'd love that. That's
me. Yeah, we were talking about that before the recording started. How's life treating you right now, fella?
I totally forgot you were still talking to me. I'm well. I'm busy. University started again, so but it's okay. We'll manage.
Well, you're always managing on this show, so if you can recover from this, I'm sure you can get through into university without any issues, dude. So, finally, we've got another newbie to the show. It's his first time here with us today. It's Glenn.
Hello.
And how are you doing? Everything good with you, fella?
All's good. All's very, very good.
Nice one.
Loving life.
Oh, is this the first time you've been on a podcast?
It's the first time. Yep. Oh,
I assure you, then, at all. As thrown together as this.
You have you've broken my cherry. Thank you.
Oh, well. I was going to bring up something else then, but I'm not going to go with that. With that, all you out there in the real world have been introduced to today's players. So we'll kick this one off by using the copper key to open up the background information on today's movie. Now, Ready Player One, it's a 2018 Steven Spielberg science fiction film based on the Ernest Cline novel of the same name. It's written by Zach Penn and stars Ty Sheridan, Olivia Cooke, Ben Mendelsohn, Lena Waithe, TJ Miller, over to you for that one, Mike, Simon Pegg and Mark Rylance. Set in 2045, it tells the story of Wade Watts, a teenage orphan who finds clues to a contest in the Oasis, a worldwide virtual reality simulation which most of the population uses to escape the real world. The story is noted for its 80s and 90s pop culture references, many of which carried over or were replaced by other references from the movie, the novel itself, including King Kong, Akira, The Shining, Back to the Future, Godzilla, Nightmare on Elm Street, and The Iron Giant.
You're not going to list them all. You'd be here forever.
Oh, I was going to say, it's going to be a four-hour show. Development of the first film began in 2010 when Warner Brothers acquired the rights to the book, with Spielberg joining the project in 2015. Filming began in England in June 2016, with principal photography completed just 2 months later. Visual effects were handled by ILM, amongst others. Now, the movie premiered at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas on March 11, 2018, with a general release in the US following shortly afterwards on March 29th. It received positive reviews from critics who praised both Spielberg's direction, visual effects, brisk pacing, and the performances of both Sheridan and Rylance. It was also a commercial success, grossing around $607 million worldwide against a $155 million budget, and earned a nomination for Best Visual Effects at the 91st Academy Awards, 24th Critics' Choice Awards, and 72nd British Academy Film Awards. It was also awarded the title of Best Science Fiction Film at the 45th Saturn, and a further two Outstanding Achievement Awards from the Visual Effects Society. I'm not used to reading information out about a film that does well. And, yeah, Ready Player One can currently be found on multiple streaming platforms, as well as DVD, Blu-ray, and here's where we begin that Mike Wilson drinking game, 4K for any fellow physical media glitzers.
I was going to say, guess how I watched it.
Yeah, with the original, take a swig, audience, with the original novel by Ernest Cline also still available. Now, I'll start off. I'm a self-confessed fan of the original novel, and yeah, it may not be your thing, Mike, but I vibe with every single reference in that one. I'm a huge retro game and movie nerd, so while I didn't make it to the cinema, I don't think it was showing here in English, or whether it was in the pandemic, I'm not quite sure. My memory's not
well
very good.
Before the pandemic.
Oh well, yeah, I'm just
2017
social,
but... maybe.
Oh God,
2018,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, okay.
It just will not have been here in English. But I did pre-order the Steelbook. I'll be honest, I was a little disappointed at first, but that's because it was so radically different in place from the novel, but that soon passed. I mean, let's be honest, the novel as it stands is basically unfilmable.
Terrible.
Without boring a good percentage of the audience. So, well, I recognise it's
basically
never
unreadable
gonna be...
without boring a certain section of the audience.
Yeah, just wait till Ready Player Two, dude. It's never going to be what I envisaged. Movie and books are obviously two very different things, and what works in one format will not work in another. Are you listening, Dune fans? Yeah. When did you guys see this one? And I'll come over to you first, Mike.
Well, I did see it in the cinema, and I will say that was the best experience I've had with it. And I'm glad that I did see it in the cinema, because the times I've watched it since, it's lost a little bit of that sheen. And the most special time was definitely, yeah, seeing all this on the big screen and really being immersed in it. I don't recall seeing it in like 3D or IMAX or anything special like that. It was just because it was a cool big screen experience. And I genuinely cannot even remember who I went with. I asked my brother when I was trying to remember, like, seeing this, and I was like, did we go and see Ready Player One? And he claims, no, he's seen it since, didn't really care for it. And I was like, huh. So either I went on my own, or whoever I was with just made no impact whatsoever, possibly because I was just engrossed in the screen. But I remember loving it. I mean, like I said, I remember coming away thinking that was fantastic. I'm a huge Spielberg fan anyway, even often the films of his that don't go down particularly well. So I appreciate it. And being a huge nerd, obviously I loved all of the references and everything. I was completely on board with that. And I should probably say that I did see the film before reading the book. I got the book after the movie because I liked the movie and tried reading it, and then, yeah, got about halfway through the book and was just like, I don't need to spend three chapters reciting war games and reading about a dude playing a high score on Pac-Man. This is just terrible.
See, that shit thrilled me. Not the war games as much, but just the Pac-Man.
It's just the worst kind of storytelling, because... like, the film, I think, gets away with all these geek references and stuff because a lot of the time they're quite fleeting, and it's point and recognize DiCaprio meme situation, whereas the book just really is one of those, like, it's like sitting next to the annoying geek in a bar who won't shut up about one thing for hours on end, and you're just like, oh, Ernest Cline, I know you like war games, but move on.
But Mike, that's you. You're one of these nerds that sit there in the bar. If somebody's sat in a bar next to you and the words Power Rangers come up, they're going to wish they were dead, dude.
I bought it and didn't see it. So thank you.
Well, I mean, maybe it just wasn't the right things that he had picked.
Did you not finish the novel then, or did you like get on a Cliff's Notes version afterwards?
No, I do. I mean, I will. I kind of want to try and finish it because I'm a completist. And I have gotten like halfway through, and occasionally we'll go back to it and try getting through it. But I couldn't possibly try and just blast through it all in one go, because like I said, I get to certain parts and I'm just like, this is dragging like a snail on a friggin' cocaine diet. I can't put up with this for very much longer.
All I'll say in that respect is then you may like the end of the book, because there are very different mechs in play. in the novel.
Okay, fair enough. And I did. I got bought Ready Player 2 for Christmas because my sister bought it for me. I think thinking, oh, this is a kind of geeky type thing, and I'm looking for a book. So, but everything you've told me about it makes me think I'm probably going to despise it.
Yeah, if you don't know the intricacies of Graffiti Bridge, or you don't love, you know, John Hughes' high school films, then yeah, you're going to want to yeet that out of the window as pretty soon as possible, to be fair. So what about you? I'll come to you first, Toby. When did you first see this, and do you remember it?
I think I did see it in cinema when it came out, pretty sure. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to go through my whole journey with this movie, but I just to quickly summarize. When I watched it, I thought it was okay. Then I became to hate it, and now I rewatch and I'm like, I don't hate this movie. I just hate everyone talking about this movie the way people have been talking about it.
Perfect podcast for you to be on. Stop talking about the movie.
This is going to be a classic.
The people I heard talking about this movie were not like us. It was like, I just say boomers. that we're all like, oh my god, this has video games, this is so perfect for you, yay. This is not your perfect movie, oh my god. I'm like, shut up, leave me alone. Go away.
Have you tried reading the novel, Toby, or is it just nothing? No. No.
What you're seeing with Toby here is a definite generation gap. Like, DK, you and I grew up in the 80s in my case, late 70s, 80s in your case. Toby probably has no frame of reference for 90% of it.
Toby's just sat there going, you old bunch of bastards. So, I'm going to come to you next, Glenn. When did you first see this one?
I bought it on day of release on Blu-ray.
Day of release?
Day of release, yeah.
Had you read the novel previously?
No, I had no interest in reading the novel.
Fair enough. What made you go for it straight away? Was it because it was a Spielberg one? Or?
No, not because it was Spielberg. Just because of the Akira, the anime references, the whole kind of like geek references. Thank goodness for a pause button on a Blu-ray. That's all I can say. Pause screen, yeah. Identify all the characters. Play, pause again, identify more characters. Just seeing all your favorite anime characters, gaming characters in one film.
Nice.
I love the design work.
I will say I did try doing that this time, but we were watching it in 3D, and my significant other just said I had to either stop doing it and just keep watching it, or she was going to leave the room. So, yeah. But with
DK, there are plenty of YouTube videos that will just do that for you, you know.
Yeah, just but type in Ready Player One. Where's the fun in that? That's, you know, I'm a gunter, dude. I just kept wishing that the Halo and Overwatch references would just get out of the way just so I could see the good stuff. Yeah. But, I mean, we've already dealt with that elephant in the room straight away. And it looks like out of the four of us, one and a half of us have kind of read the novel. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded again of there was a quote that Paul Verhoeven used when making Starship Troopers. And it says, I want to make a movie that's so painfully obvious that I didn't read the book, that everyone who has read the book is constantly psychologically tormented by those who have only seen the movie. And I find that incredibly apt in this one. But again, it is what it is. And I think, you know, if you've been in any, as I mentioned earlier, if you've been in any Dune groups on the internet recently, you'll know that a movie adaptation and a book adaptation can be two very different things.
The good thing in this case is at least it's the same writer as well. Like, Ernest Cline was rewritten by Zach Penn, but he still wrote the film screenplay. So the book fans can't be like, oh, Cline would never have written this, because he did.
Yeah, it was one of his stipulations, I believe, that he wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, that he would only sign away the rights to the film if he could write that. And to me, some of it works, some of it doesn't. I mean, obviously, it's different strokes. I pick up on different things. But that, I mean, you know, conveniently, nice segue there, that leads us into the writing in the movie by, you know, with regard, instead of the novel. So I'm just thinking, what are you writing to the writing on this one? And I'll come to you first on this one, Glenn.
It's okay. The main teenage characters can get a little annoying, like most films with teenage characters in. It's a little bit simplistic. I remember one scene where... do we do spoilers? Can we talk about...
Oh, yeah.
We assume people have seen
long
the film.
Since passed yeah. on this.
Just in case. Yeah. It kind of like... his aunt dies in an explosion, and it's kind of like, oh, my aunt's died. Let's get on with the story. And it's like a blink moment, yet a part of his life has just ended. And it's kind of like, well, that's going to interfere with the action, so just keep moving forward. So I think the best parts are anything Mark Rylance says. That's got real depth. They've written him so well. Whereas everybody else is just playing kind of stock characters. You know, using dialogue you've heard in practically every teen action movie. So the adult characters do get some real depth. I mean, Mark Rylance is excellent. And the things he gets to say, the actual writing for him is superb. But I just think the rest is just a little bit cliche.
It's weirdly enough, I'll mention to the audience and that I know you from before this podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, there are certain times when listening to Mark Rylance in this that it does remind me of you. I'm not, please don't take that as an insult.
It's a compliment. It's an absolute compliment. Thank you.
Oh, nice one. Well, I mean, you know, with that in mind, Halliday's Oasis avatar is named Anorak. And for those of you not in the UK, it's a slightly derogatory slang term for someone with an obsessive, comprehensive interest in a particular aspect of pop culture.
And some of us wear it with pride. Some of us wear it with absolute pride.
Exactly. So, yeah. So I'll come to you, Toby. What's your first impressions on the writing of the movie?
Well, first of all, I agree with everything said before and want to double down on the well writing of Halliday. Not only he is written well, but I think his whole story is really well written. I really like that. This movie tries to do a capitalism critique, and it's a little bit baby's first capitalism critique. And it's fine. It's if you're looking for death, don't try.
It is a very kind of superficial thing. I will say that the you know, skipping ahead, the novel for Ready Player Two isn't as shallow as this one. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
does it have bigger stakes than We Don't Want Ads?
It does. The problem is it's such an escalation. Yeah. But at least
it doesn't feel like you're going through all of this to not have to pay for the full Netflix subscription, essentially.
Dude, I would happily go through shit like this to not have to pay for a Netflix subscription.
Well, you know what I mean, though? It's like, I don't want to have to pay less for the ad-supported plan. Yeah, How dare you? How dare you, Mendo Mendelsohn?
Yeah. Well, one thing I liked about everything was that he tried to destroy the Oasis. That's one thing where I'm like, that's actually really nice because it's really relevant that a lot of companies rather try to destroy everything instead of not profiting of it. Like, there is no real loss if they don't get it. I mean, obviously they want to get it, but they don't. Okay. But then they're like, no, rather it doesn't exist, then it exists for free somewhere else. That's the one thing I really like.
That's the rest of the critique is believable.
And that, like, kind of the smallest references obviously had to be cleared by the legal team, which meant that things obviously, you know, seen in the movies slightly differ from those in the book. They were saying that there were some things that they couldn't get, but they didn't want to call them out because they just didn't want to give them a press. One big omission from the book is Ultraman. Although it was left out because of a long-running dispute over who actually owns the rights rather than because the creators refused permission. But
that's an entire wormhole you could fall down for years.
Exactly. They saw that as a mixed blessing, not to have it, you know. So they had to kind of come up with other things. For, you know, example, the Iron Giant, they relied more on, how should we say, Warner Brothers properties.
There's no Megazord in that final fight, by the way. There's so many giant mechs and no Power Rangers Zords. Come on, man.
I think you will like that bit of the novel. Okay. Yeah, and I do like the little thing that during the race sequence, the marquee of the theatre can be seen. He reads Schwarzenegger in Jack Slater 3.
Yep.
And which was also written by Zach Penn, and he wasn't actually aware of it until the release of the trailer.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I'm a little torn because obviously I'm a big fan of the book. When it comes to people like Ogden Morrow, played by Simon Pegg, he plays a much larger role in the book. Obviously, you know, there's that little reveal at the end of this one. But he's actually, you see the real Ogden Morrow from, I would say, the midpoint in the book. And I like that they went with certain sections that they thought would be obviously better suited to film, because, as you know, we've already alluded to, it would just be basically unfilmable without it. But I do think it loses some of the, some of the story in the translation. So I don't know. I'm kind of here and there, I don't know. I mean, this is one for you, Mike. You'll appreciate this. It was the book itself was the subject of a podcast called 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back, where comedians Mike Nelson of Mystery Science Theatre 3000 and Connor Listowska, who was the author of the show Riff Tracks, who Mike also stars on, they read a chapter each week and scrutinised them. At the end, they concluded they just did not care for it. So then, after the release of the film, they performed an episode dedicated to discussing the movie and how it, too, did not meet their standards. So you can officially find a commentary for Ready Player One on Riff Tracks. So, I think I might check that one out.
We should probably be sponsored by Mystery Science Theatre 3000.
We should. and that's the second... Second part of the drinking game. Take a swig, everyone. So yeah, I think it was it might have been Toby who mentioned it was very, or was it you, Glenn? It was very simplistic, and
both of us, I think.
Yeah, get that in the translation from the novel to the movie. It comes across, and this is another thing that you'll love, Mike. It comes across to me in places very much like as if you're watching a Tron version of the Goonies. It seemed a very kind of, in parts, a very kind of also kid friendly thing. I remember in the original novel, they kill off one of the characters, and they just, I was waiting for that to happen in the movie, and it just doesn't happen. So,
I have a lot of thoughts on the writing, but I will say I completely disagree that it's oversimplified. I think they actually. I prefer it to the book because it is more streamlined and because it doesn't bog you down in the minutiae and everything. I think for me, it actually flows a lot better. And it probably plays a lot better to, you know, I mean, we are huge nerds, but 90% of the cinema audience probably aren't. And I would imagine to a normie, for want of a better word, it probably plays a lot better than if they were to be like, and now let's do a deep dive into this nerdy thing for the next half an hour. You know, if you don't know it and you don't get the reference or whatever, you can move on to the next thing. You can still follow it as an adventure story, a Spielberg movie in its own right. If you do get it, then you can be like, ooh, look, it's whatever. It's the alien chess buster. Yay,
it's fucking Chucky.
Yeah. It's the DeLorean. It's the Akira bike. It's whatever else. And then whoever you're with who hasn't seen any of these things will be like, shut up, I'm watching a movie.
Exactly. Which, I mean, obviously, it's... We can't get through the writing without mentioning the references, and we're not, as you know, Mike said earlier, we'll not mention them all because we'll be forever. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have any particular favourite references from this one? And I'll come to you first, Glenn. Anything that, you know, kind of stands out?
I mean, I think
member very wise.
Yeah, I think we all agree the Akira bike, the Gundam. Most any there's Chun-Li in it several times. Anything Japanese related, anything anime related, games related. I mean, he's already mentioned the chest buster scene, which was hysterical. Mm. Going from the forearm thing from
Mortal Kombat
to suddenly that unzips its chest and the chest buster comes down. It's a glove puppet. I mean, that was just wonderful, incredible scene. So it's just a little bits and pieces like that that you just, your eyes pop out and you're like, whoa, that's amazing. And again, things like that, just for a nerd or a geek or an anorak, it's just, wow, this is my kind of film. I've seen all this, I've played all this, or I've read this, and there it is on screen mixed in with everything else, all the things I love. It's wonderful.
Nice. What about you, Toby? Is anything that kind of floated your boat with references on this one?
I mean, I liked the Gundam. That was nice. I thought the King Kong was fun.
I think that is one of the changes, isn't it, from the book, DK, where there's no race in the book at all.
Yeah, there's no race whatsoever.
Yeah, so...
I do like the race. I do like it. I mean,
beautifully shot.
Yeah,
beautifully
what we've got, we've got Bigfoot, the DeLorean, the Akira bike, obviously. We've got the Mach 5 Batmobile, the A-Team van, Christine...
T-Rex. Big T-Rex. Yeah.
The Porkchop Express from Big Trouble in Little China. Trans Am.
Yeah, which took me ages to see, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, had you not seen it before I mentioned it?
No, it took me a while to see it because I was looking for references to things you would like this time around. And I looked online and saw the van from Big Trouble in Little China and I was like, was it? Then went back and was like, oh, yeah.
I mean, what stood out for you reference-wise in this?
Oh, well, you know me. So, I mean... From the race, obviously, I was very grateful that Spielberg acquiesced a little bit to have some references of his. Because initially he was like, I don't want to sound egotistical and have any of my references. But I did get a thrill from seeing the Jurassic Park T-Rex. So I was kind of glad he included that. I thought that was awesome. And again, if you know me at all, I loved Halliday's funeral. It was Star Trek themed. He was buried in Spock's torpedo tube coffin. I mean, at the very end battle, Serenity turns up from Firefly. Right there. That's a full star worthy right there. That's just, oh, I love that. I mean, Mecha Godzilla, come on, you know me again. So yeah. I love that shit. Anytime. I mean, I even like the fact that both Sorrento's disguise, as much as there is one, and when Artemis is trying to disguise Parsival, they are like Superman references because I'm a huge Superman fan, as you know. So I like that. Yeah. Sorrento kind of looks like the everyone that doesn't get the character's idea of Superman, which is he's just big and burly and will F you up. And then to disguise Parsival, he becomes basically the cool Christopher Reeve Clark Kent version with the glasses and the little comb down. So I appreciated anything like that. And then obviously all the stuff we've already mentioned and all the stuff that gets a shout out, but you don't see, like in H's workshop when she's like, we have the Battlestar Galactica in here. We've got the Harkonnen dropship that gets you from here to Arrakis or whatever. And she references a whole load of stuff. the DeLorean. Good.
There's a 2001 pod in the background in the workshop.
Yeah,
as well.
The EVA pod. Yeah, absolutely.
The TARDIS is supposed to be there, but I didn't see it.
Oh, I briefly did, but it's very background. Yeah. In talking of like references, it took me far too long to realize. It took me about 3 watches before I realized that the DeLorean has Kit's light on the front, the moving red lights from Kit from Knight Rider.
Yeah.
I was like, come on, Parsival, pick a reference. You can't mix and match.
Well, in the novel, it's got the Ghostbusters symbol on the doors as well. But
they couldn't get the rights for that, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to go with, I love the Zemeckis cube.
That was what I was going to say, because, I mean, I know it's leaping to another section, but I love that Alan Silvestri did the music for this, and Spielberg was like, rip yourself off as much as you want.
Yeah.
So the Zemeckis cube actually plays the Back to the Future theme.
I've also loved the fact that orb of Ossovox is kept in the box that holds Gizmo from Gremlins. And I love and the spell that they use is the making charm from Excalibur. Mm. But But Mike, you'll know what my other than the Atari 2600 reference, which I will always die for. But yeah, you know my favourite reference in this, Mike. So go on, see if you can guess it.
It's definitely going to be the Buckaroo Banzai.
It is. I don't know.
Even though, according to somebody on the internet, Buckaroo Banzai never wears that costume in the film, just for publicity photos. So there's a bit of a nerd reference for you.
Yeah, he wears a slightly different version of it when he's in the club at the start, but they are right in that. But anyway, yep. we're getting into
it. I knew you'd know that.
Yeah. Anyway, moving swiftly on. So, yeah, Warner Brothers and Daniel DeLine, they acquired the rights to Kline's novel while it was in Galliform in a bidding contest, beating rival studios Paramount and 20th Century Fox, both who were rapidly running down the toilet. Mind you, this is a Warner Brothers film. Kline stipulated two conditions with the studio. He and Eric Eason gets the first attempt to write the script in his book, and Kline wants Spielberg to direct it. So, yeah, he got his wish on that. Spielberg cites this as the third most difficult movie he's ever made in his career, behind Jaws and Saving Private Ryan. Apparently, the alien ship from his version of War of the Worlds is in this, but I never saw that either.
It's in the scene which introduces I-Rock. He comes out of a crashed...
No, that was the 1950s Gene Barry version.
That's right.
That was the George Powell version. Yeah, that was the George Powell version. Martian War Machine. Yeah.
Sorry. I'm sure it is. There is probably a Spielberg one there, but again, in that last battle, there are so many things you can... there are hundreds of characters running at the speed at any one time.
Yeah.
There's literally debate about whether it's the Ninja Turtles or the Battletoads that are in there, because you can't really tell.
I thought it was the modern... Well, the...
The Michael Bay.
Yeah, I blocked that name from my memory, but yeah, it's the Michael Bay versions, I think.
It is, yeah. They have the... he had one of the characters has the lenses on his forehead when he's like the inventor. He's got all the lenses on his forehead when he's fighting.
I don't know if any of you guys were aware, but at the time that they were filming this, they were asking modders and CG artists to send in characters that they could be included in that battle scene. And our very own Ian from The Big Trouble in Little China, he sent some characters. I'm not sure 100% if they used them, but he definitely took part in that, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
So... Yeah, apparently during filming, Spielberg donned a VR headset and wandered around the sets with a virtual camera, lying on the floor to check out camera angles and set up shots, and just kept saying, "This is crazy!" So, but yeah, it was his first movie to gross over $100 million domestically since 2012's Lincoln. So I'm just wondering, when it comes to the direction, is there anything that stands out for you guys? What do you think of this one? You know, especially considering it's Spielberg, basically.
I have to be honest that I think I couldn't really see any Spielberg in it. I think this could have been directed by any competent director. I couldn't find any real connect. I couldn't find anything to do with to make it a Spielberg film. I think any good director could have done it. I don't see any kind of whoa, that's definitely Spielberg. It just seems very simple.
I can sense the rage building, but I'm gonna have to second that. I associate.
Oh.
But because I always,
I have the power to mute you, you know.
I know, but I don't know. It doesn't have that Spielberg warmth to me, and I don't know if that's kind of a disconnect. No. So I'm gonna come to you, Mike, because you're the Spielberg expert here, and say,
not expert.
Compared to the rest of us.
Before you say something, I'm gonna further it just to make you angry. So.
I do get Spielberg vibes from this, not always positively, just to surprise you a little bit, because I think part of it is the thing you said is that and that Glenn kind of brought up as well, is that it's overly family friendly, which kind of hurts the stakes, so bad things can happen, like you killed my mom's sister, haha, but they're not really allowed to have any impact or effect because it's a family-friendly kind of family movie, or, you know, even down to Parsifal's, like, well, my parents died when I was very young, and it's a throwaway line. It's barely addressed.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you could potentially make a really, like, a powerful and dark movie about how society has collapsed into these stacks. And credit where it's due, Spielberg does make The Real World look drab and kind of washed out and has this weird brownie filter on it compared to The Oasis's bright, shiny awesomeness. But it never really gets into, like, society's crumbled, my dude. It's post-apocalypse here. And you're just like, oh, well.
on a similar line, Artemis tells you how her father died in one of the work cubes. And again, that's just brushed straight over. My father suffered. He put all his money into buying gear, got into debt, went into a cube, worked himself to death, and then that's just brushed over again. They're on with the story.
Yeah, it gives her a motivation so that you get the chance to do the kind of punch the air, you got your revenge moment.
Yeah.
Because again, that's the kind of thing, the kind of thing you would have is, like, you've got to have these moments that people can always appreciate. But, like, I've mentioned it to you off air, I'm sure, DK, and I don't necessarily blame Spielberg as the director, but, like, the changing of the characters Parsifal and Artemis is the two worst things, because in the book, Wade is basically, like, overweight, skin problems, you know, stereotypical nerd type guy. And
I don't know what you mean. He says, avoiding all mirrors.
I mean. Yeah, exactly. There's a reason I'm not on screen right now. But, like, that is more relatable to the book reader. I'll give, you know, Ernest Cline that much. And then when it came to the movie, they were like, let's cast Hollywood's young heartthrob, you know, future Cyclops Ty Sheridan. Like, the fuck? This guy's never going to have any problem connecting in the real world. And then the absolute ridiculousness of casting Olivia Cook?
Olivia Harrington Cook.
Yeah, Olivia Cook, and then giving her a birthmark that would, I don't give a shit. That's, you know what I mean? It's supposed to be like this thing, and I genuinely took the piss out of it so much because it's still fucking Olivia Cook. She's one of the hottest women, you know, acting today, certainly for her age group. And in that scene when she brushes her hair away and reveals the birthmark, I sent you the screen grab, didn't I, DK, and was like, oh, look at this troll. I'm just still like a 99% gorgeous beauty woman. What are you on about?
Yeah, I do love how Ty Sheridan, after this film, was cast as the guy with the visor, though.
Yeah, we saw him and we're like, he spent 90% of the last film with a visor over his eyes. We know he can do it.
So
there was a nice touch about the birthmark when you saw Artemis in the final scenes and she had a pixelated birthmark on her face.
When she shoots at Mechagodzilla's eye so that Sorrento can see who it is that's doing it. That's what I mean. Punch the air, she got a revenge kind of thing.
It's beautiful. That's a really nice part, having a pixelated birthmark.
Absolutely.
Helen Mirren voiceover when you need it.
But, like, in terms of, I've criticized, like, Parsifal and Artemis, but on the other hand of that, I do like that they actually embrace that H has, like, a gender swap thing going on. Like, the idea being that, you know, online, it doesn't have to be for nefarious means, but you can be whatever you want to be, including a preferred gender, or, you know, remove these stereotypes. She befriended Wade, and he might not necessarily have done that in the real world. And so it plays into the more positive aspects of hidden identity as opposed to the negative, like, ooh, what's the sinister motive here? Or, you know, ooh, I'm hiding my hideous birthmark, whatever.
And in the Shining scene, H was going to get it on with the woman coming out of the bathtub, the naked woman.
Oh, yeah. You know
what?
Like,
why not? Why not?
But if, I mean, it flashes back to you know the opening lines. It's one of my favourite, where it says, "People come to the Oasis for all the things they can do, but they stay for all the things that they can be."
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
I do
like that. I will say, with regards to the direction, that they did nail The Shining. Other than, you know, obviously the section where it turns into Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
But, which it's really weird to have two films in the same decade that return to the, you know, the Overlook. And I think this one does really well. And
I love Dr. Sleep, but I like this because, as you know, I'm a fan of The Shining, as I mentioned. I think I mentioned it during our 2001 review, and somebody that was on that didn't like The Shining, but liked 2001, but I love The Shining.
I mean, I'm not a big Kubrick fan, but I do like that Spielberg, you know, kind of paid respect to Kubrick's shots and...
Oh, so completely as well, though.
Oh, it's when that music starts. As soon as that music starts, the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. It's incredible.
I do have to say, though, that the film kind of, the part of the suspense of it has been killed for me by The Simpsons. Parody, because when H is caught off guard by the blood, I cannot not picture Mr. Burns going, "That's unusual. The blood normally gets off at the third floor."
All work and no play makes Homer go something something. Go crazy. Don't mind if I do.
Tell you what, we come back here and everyone's dead. I owe you a coke.
So yeah, I mean, other than the you know, the basic family friendliness of all this, what stood out for you as a particularly, you know, Spielberg moments, Mike?
I think just the sweetness, the interaction between the characters, and the fact that, like I said, if you want to try and find a thread among Spielberg's films, it's always about family, whether that's literal or found family. And like, the biggest thread you could potentially argue this film is that Wade starts off the film by saying, you know, "I'm not a clan person, I'm out to get this for myself," and then ends the movie with, like, "My conditions are that if we're going to do this and take this over, it's got to be me and my, you know, the whole high five, the clan of five of us." Yeah. So he's literally found his family. That is what the movie's about. And I think that's like I said, it's very common in Spielberg movies. And just, you know, human connections and stuff like that, little bits and pieces. And evil is always clearly defined and evil and always gets its comeuppance in the end, which again happens here, even though it probably wouldn't realistically happen in, you know, in the actual real world. It wouldn't be like, "And then the evil corporation collapsed and everything was fine." Yeah, I wish.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think to the change with regards to the fact that in the novel, Daito dies? Do you think that would have kind of upped the stakes a little, or do you think it would have been an unnecessary addition and Spielberg did right by changing it?
I don't think it would have ruined the film, but it would certainly have tainted it, and it would have made that ending a lot. But then again, there's moments, like I said, there's moments where it does come off very toothless. And like I said, I haven't reached the end of the novel, so I don't know how the novel ends. But I always thought the ending of this was incredibly just, like, weak. That they kind of realize, you know, his whole spiel, how it is all spiel about, you know, "Oh, the world sucks, but it's the only place you can get a good meal." And they come to realize the world is great. And then they're like, "Oh, so controversially, we closed the Oasis 2 days a week." I'm like, really? That is the most half-assed thing you could possibly do.
Like, just 2 off days. What if these are the only days I have time?
Yeah. I'm working on that. Yeah. I'm working every other day. You pricks.
But even then, it's like, it's 2 days out of 7, and that's the best you can do. Like, I know that the movie is all about the wonder of the Oasis, and which is a cipher for the internet and all the great things you can do. But I almost would prefer that if they'd won the contest, they kind of realized, yeah, the real world is ultimately what we're going to have to try and fix. So let's just scrap the Oasis completely, as opposed to this. No, we're giving it a round, but, you know, 2 days, we're not allowed to, go on it. Like, oh, come on.
Yeah. That kind of is, I will say, in the novel, it is kind of similar. So when I was saying, finish the novel, maybe not. But in Ready Player 2 does actually pick up on that plot line. And it becomes an important plot line between some of the characters.
Yeah, fair enough.
But, yeah. To be honest, Daito dying, I don't think would have changed that much, because the softness of this movie is so ingrained in it that, like, if we add a death, like, I don't know, maybe a little, but it would even maybe feel like out of place in this movie, because it's kind of its thing that it's so soft, and, you know, hate it or love it, I don't like it. but I think if you want to go for more darker tone, you would really have to start a new draft. Do something else.
The thing for me that kind of, like, the reason that I think you can't really have it in this film is that, even though whilst people do die, they are explicitly portrayed as being deserving of it, like nasty people. Like, we should potentially have feelings about the fact that Wade's aunt and her boyfriend die, except they've been portrayed as such jerks to him in every scene that when they die, you're more just like, oh, good. I mean, it's like you can't just die and shockingly be like, wow, sometimes people just die in these in the fight for goodness. So I think if they were gonna kill off Daito, you'd have to see him doing something terrible, like kick a puppy or something beforehand. So like, yeah. Oh, he deserved it.
I think that might be one of the problems. That might be why I see it as kind of like a Goonies version, because the whole, you know, thing, the whole last act where they're racing around in the van and you've got this huge chase sequence and you've got Wade falling this way and that way and affecting how he would, you know, move in the Oasis and stuff. None of that's in the book. Or if I am, you know, if I'm mistaken, audience, please don't, you know, at me. But it's, as I say, it all feels very Goonies to me. And yeah.
I know what you mean, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's no finale character in the book. And as a henchman, she's not threatening. She's very Bebop and Rocksteady. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you are the most inept possible. Like, Hannah John Carman is a fantastic actress, and I'm always happy to see her on screen because, you know, visually pretty appealing. But she's so bad at her job in this.
Yeah. But let's be honest, Sorrento's no great, you know, corporate climber in this. He's just, mind you, we're talking about this from real world where people...
I was going to say, you don't have to be competent to end up running a company. Yeah. Elon Musk.
Or the country.
Exactly, yeah.
What do you think to the acting in general? I'll come to you first, Toby, on this one.
I mean, the acting is fine, I guess. I don't have any strong feelings about it, to be honest.
I've got to hold Toby back. He just loves this movie so much.
I have to look for, just this is a note for my future editing self, I have to look for the gif of the filthy neutrals from Futurama anytime Toby talks and just put up, I have no strong feelings one way or the other.
So there wasn't really a standout for you in this one then, Toby?
No. Like, really, the acting is like, I mean, it's like, it's not terrible, but it's not amazing. It's like, people are acting and... acting.
There's a lot of
acting involved.
Okay, all right then. What about you, Glenn? Any standouts?
I didn't see anybody acting. I just saw people reading the lines. I didn't see really any acting in the whole movie. I think the acting was from the CGI characters. They did all the acting. All the kind of Oasis segments. The actual real life human beings, I didn't really see them acting at all. All the emotion and all the kind of the drama came from the Oasis, scenes in the Oasis. The actual human side, I didn't see really anybody breaking a sweat. I saw one tear rolling down Wade's face at the very end under his visor, but I'm sure that was just a drop of like a, you know, pipette drop. He didn't actually cry, you know, acting.
Well, I mean, you guys all praised already Mark Rylance. So I will say it, just to contradict your points. And I want to love Mark Rylance in this, and I can see that he's doing a great job, but I'll never forgive him for stealing that Best Supporting Actor Oscar from Stallone, because he did. He stole it. I'm not having it any other way. That was Stallone's for Creed. It will always be Stallone's for Creed. I don't care what the history books say. I will cross it out every time I come across it and write, so unless it's Stallone. Fucking Bridge of Spies, my ass, Mark Rylance. But anyway, I do agree with you with in regards to like Ty Sheridan isn't really doing anything spectacular. I always feel bad insulting actors because that's their job, but anybody could have done that role. I didn't particularly feel he brought anything to it, but I did think Olivia Cooke did a great job with Artemis. Maybe that's just because I've got a massive crush on her anyway, particularly after seeing her in House of the Dragon now as well. But I thought she did a good job of portraying, like, you've got this horrible cliche of, like, love at first sight and this man's fallen in love that barely knows you. It's really difficult to pull that off in a believable way. And I was like, all right, I can buy that you'd kind of fall for this woman. She's got a certain charm. So I give her credit for that. I think Lena Waithe was fantastic as H, because, again, you've got quite a task there. You're playing, you know, in the Oasis for the entire first half of the movie. You're, you know, a burly dude. Then you reveal yourself in the real world and you're a woman. And... yeah, I think she holds that part really well. And I think the child actor who played, is it Shaw of the two guys? For a child actor, he's really good, because child actors can, 90% of the time, they're going to just be precocious and annoying. Mm. And he was pretty good. I mean, he didn't get a lot of lines, but I chuckled a few times when he was like, oh, what am I going to advertise that I'm 11 years old? Kill me first, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, oh, he did a good job. But yeah, the rest of them, as you say, Ben Mendelsohn is just, you know, what do you want? Stock villain number three again? All right, no problem. I mean, like I said, Hannah John Carman, she's trying her best, but she just comes across like Dick Dastardly and Muttley at how much she's letting these teenage kids get away from her, you know. Yeah. But I thought of a couple of great performances anyway.
I've got to say, I'm like you with Rylance with regards to Simon Pegg in this. It just feels like he kind of sleepwalks through what little he has. I mean, I do like the, you know, the Arthur Treacher curator.
Yes.
Is okay. Yeah. But when he turns up at the end, it just seems so much like an afterthought. We've kind of touched on the acting, what little there is, but it brings us to the, you know, as Glenn mentioned earlier, the Oasis, the animation. It's notorious for dating really badly. Do you think the animation still kind of holds up? I mean, I know it's only been, you know, 5 years, but what do you think?
I think so, but I found myself thinking that when I watched it, like the CGI characters, they don't feel fake at all.
Nope.
It's amazing what they pull off with it. Sorry, yeah, Glenn, you go.
No, I agree completely. I mean, it still look the close-ups of the characters' faces, irises and pores and tattoos and skin tone. It's in close-up visuals. It's as good as anything like in the recent Avatar movie. It still holds up brilliantly well. It really does.
Okay.
Yeah. The Overlook Hotel inside looks so realistic, incredibly realistic.
I did read that was partly because Spielberg literally pulled out the original shooting schematics and camera placement and everything, so he literally was able to copy exactly the way Kubrick shot it by following those plans. And man, you can tell because that's authentic and it really feels
incredible. Yeah.
I do have a note that I'm hoping you haven't gotten. I might stand on your toes on this one. But talking about the Shining sequence, the fact that they post-processed it with film grain and aging effects so that, like, even though it's a brand new movie, it more closely resembled The Shining because it was made in 1980. It's just amazing, that level of detail. Again, that's a Spielberg thing for me, is that it should really stand out or jar in this movie, but it actually just lends it that air of authenticity and that kind of cool, all right, I get what you're doing here. And in terms of, I mean, I know it's more direction than VFX production design, arguably, but like, again, Spielberg for me is a master of like shot composition and stuff. And for me, there's that shot that stands out for me every time when they're just standing ready for the epic final battle. And it's almost silhouetted on the mountaintop. And it's like the silhouette of the Iron Giant and then the kind of ninja guy, then Parsifal. And they're all stood up against like this weird blue sky with the force field in the background. It just looks incredible. That's the kind of thing I would have as like a painting just stuck in my house. It's like, this is so cool looking. And, you know, it could have been phoned in, but I don't think it was. And I think the whole final battle's like that. It could have been a mess. I mean, if you look at the way certain directors, Michael Bay, film, you know, huge action sequences with giant robots and people running and stuff.
Everything's delineated. You know where you're going. I don't think for a second you lose track of where you're supposed to be. They're handling that many characters at that point that you think it would be so easy to just mess this up. But at that point, it blends it with the live action thing so well. Like, you know, when the Sixers are being taken out and in the final battle and it cuts back to the headquarters and they're all turning red because they've just been...
I love that scene where it's like a line of them that get knocked down in a row like dominoes, just...
Yeah, and like that scene where, you know, they throw Chucky and then it cuts back to, you know, the headquarters and everybody's just basically being maimed in various ways and they're just turning red.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? You got anything else to add on that? Or you
no, I've
much...
talked enough. I really haven't. The only other thing I have notes on is the music, but I'll wait until you take us there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're getting onto that. We might as well go straight on. I mean, obviously, it was supposed to be scored by John Williams, but due to scheduling conflicts, which was the post, he was working on the post for Spielberg, he left, which saw Anne Silvestri taking over. And it was only the third film that Spielberg didn't collaborate with Williams.
Mm.
So, and so go for it, Mike. We'll go straight in with you on this one.
Being a geek, I recognised a few things and looked them up to make sure of it. And yeah, sure enough, the Max Steiner theme from the original King Kong does play when he jumps down onto the racetrack. Akira Ifukube's main theme from Godzilla plays as Mechagodzilla rises. Makes no absolute sense why the 54 Godzilla film would play to Mechagodzilla, but, you know, we don't question these things. And obviously the score from The Shining by, I think it was Wendy Carlos. And Rachel Elkind. Yeah, just completely, like you said, was it you, Glenn, that brought up as soon as you see it and you hear that atmospheric music and they walk into every it, you're time. Like, yep, this is The Shining. Yeah.
Yep. Every time.
Yeah. Other than that, as I said, I think the soundtrack just nails it. It nails what it's supposed to be because, I mean, effectively, Holiday Anorak is meant to be us. And by us, I mean all of us here except Toby, obviously. those of us that grew up with this.
We are Holiday, Toby is show.
Yeah, that's not far off, actually.
He drives the Gundam. He prefers to be Daito.
It was still, like, there were... It could have been also something else, wasn't it, like, typecast for this moment. Staying Alive is very typecast for this moment.
Right.
And every time this moment happens in any movie, so it's like, well...
It's because they're all ripping off Saturday Night Fever, don't we?
Yeah. Could have surprised us a little, maybe.
Do you feel like they could have maybe in some sections gone for less obvious choices and that would have made better sense?
I mean... I think they do for the most part. I just think that one was very, very...
on the nose, yeah.
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 Maybe just a different BG song would have been even surprising.
There's not a lot of choices you could have had because it's just to go with the whole Dance Dance Revolution kind of situation. Yeah. So anything that had a beat you could have used. But as you say, I think they went with Staying Alive because everyone associates that with stereotypical winning a dance competition Saturday Night Fever, you know.
Yeah.
So,
I get a similar vibe that it's obviously typecast, but I don't think it makes it any less impactful where they start playing Twisted Sister in the final battle.
We're not going to take it as a brilliant choice of Rebel Anthem. I mean, come on, even Rock of Ages uses it for the same reason, man. Which wasn't that far removed from this movie, actually.
Yeah, I think some of the songs just work. Yeah. Just work.
But then you hit the
end credits, and is it Hall & Oates?
Yeah, just...
it just seems to go instant cheese.
Yeah. Tears for Fears as he goes into the Oasis, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Great choice. There's Eurythmics in here, Sweet Dreams, somewhere, I'm told. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention after our previous podcast, Pure Imagination, obviously.
So, yeah.
Yeah, love it.
There's a couple of things that's kind of... Maybe I missed it. Maybe I was just zoning out at that point. The whole Parzival Artemis thing. They turn up in the nightclub and, you know... He's met her a couple of times in the movie. Do you think it was realistic for him to fall for her that quickly? I mean, it seemed fast to me, even as a nerd.
Did you actually see her avatar? I think anybody would love it at first sight. I think it's probably one of the main reasons I actually wanted to watch the movie, because I just saw one still picture of her avatar.
Yeah. And on a not even physical level, I'm not being funny, but if... there's even a slightly attractive woman who comes up to me and has nerd knowledge, I'm just like, I love you. Can we get married?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Even as nerds, would you be like that? Honestly?
Oh, yeah. I am like that. Would I be like? I am like that is me.
Yep. Somewhere Freeman is like locking all the doors. So, yeah, I mean, we're getting onto the legacy now, and you know the inevitable sequel based on the follow-up novel is reportedly in development. And considering, you know, how different this movie is from the novel, I can't imagine book purists being excited for this next one. Outside of the basic framework, you know, and for those of you out there who haven't read it, I'm not going to go into spoilers, but as I said, unless you're a fan of John Hughes movies, specifically his high school stuff or Prince, then it may not be entirely your thing.
There's no saying they're going to adapt that, though. I mean, if
they're going to do away with like War Games in this and stuff like that and the intricacies of following a script, I very much doubt they're going to do it for something as... I'm not being funny here to any fans, but niche or... whoever Robert Downey Jr. plays in a certain John Hughes movie, that I can't see happening. Yeah. But I'm just generally, is it something that you would be excited for?
I would be. I mean, like I said, there's no telling what they're going to include, because like, even on the flip side of things, there's no reference to The Shining in the book, yet we got it in the movie. So who's to say what kind of cool stuff we could not get in the sequel? Mm. And if it's still Spielberg and it's still the same kind of writers involved and everything, and I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be thrilled about the actors returning in terms of like Ty Sheridan and stuff, but
yeah. Yeah, what about you, Glenn?
As long as we just don't get another rehash of the first film. You know, they know what worked in the first film. I just don't want to see it repeated. You know, throw all new, you know, relevant game characters, say, from the 90s or the 2000s. You don't just want to see all the 80s references replaced by modern references and just do a similar kind of skit. Oh, look, there's so-and-so. And there's, you know, all the modern kind of like gaming characters and anime characters. Just don't rehash the first film.
Yeah.
Sorry to keep interrupting. You know, I'm jumping in a lot, but I would say I will need better stakes as well. Like, if it ends with, and then we also close the Oasis on a Wednesday.
if they do stick, as I say, if they do stick to the framework of the book, even if they change the events around in it, then the difficulty curve is considerable, you know, in comparison to the first one.
Then we require two-factor authentication to access the Oasis.
What I'm like, I have to do these picture sorting things.
Are you a robot?
How many buses are in this game? Dang it.
Click on the pictures with traffic lights. What about you, Toby? Would you be, you know, is it something that you'd be excited for? Would you go and see? Or knowing how you've kind of been with this one, is it something that you just think, oh, wait until it's on TV or something?
I mean, I probably would see it. I don't need it. I don't think it's really necessary. I don't know. I feel like if they give me something elevated, something different, then yeah, I'm interested in that. But if it's just like they're doing kind of the same thing again, it's like we've done that, we've been there, I don't know. We don't need again.
Fair enough. So yeah,
we don't need another like what's Ralph Wrecks the Internet or something. Like, please don't.
Oh, that film was terrible.
What was that?
Ralph Breaks the Internet. What an awful movie.
Oh, I thought you loved it, Mike. I remember.
I
loved
the first record, Ralph.
I remember your glowing review of "Breaks the Internet" on the Disney.
Yeah.
So now we've got Jade Keen Hand. We're gonna move on to our favourite line, character, and scene in a moment. But before we do, is there anything you guys want to draw attention to that we think we might have missed or?
I think we've covered most of it. I mean, most of the outstanding scenes we've already discussed. All the other little gems are just personal, I think. Things that you'd see and go, ooh. I think at one point, when he shoots Artemis to decoy her, I think he uses the blaster from the TV Battlestar Galactica. It's little things
That's
like that.
That's what it is. It was bugging the hell out of me what gun that was. I was racking my brains.
Yeah, it's the Battlestar TV Galactica blaster.
When you're mentioning as well, would I fall in love with Artemis as quickly? She uses a pulse rifle from Aliens.
There you go. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And something I forgot to point out, Mike, when you're on about the little cues from King Kong and stuff like that.
Yeah.
During the race, when the Batmobile skids, it skids from the Batmobile, the Batman theme.
No, 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 no.
Yep.
Yeah.
These little things like that personal things that you just look at and go, oh, that's just wonderful. That's just perfect.
Cool. So, we're in a moment, we're going to get to you, the audience's feedback. But before that, we're going to go around, each of us here, to find out their own personal highlights from the movie, favourite character, line, and scene. And we'll kick things off with our favourite character. So, Glenn, I'm coming to you first. Who's your favourite in this and why?
Oh, you already know. It's Artemis. Samantha. Most definitely.
Any particular reason other than
her looks?
The obvious.
I think she is the most real character. Her dialogue seems more realistic. The scene where she confronts Wade about falling, giving his real name, and falling in love with her when he doesn't know who she is, what she is. That speech she gives as they're escaping the nightclub. I think that's probably one of the best acted scenes in the whole movie. And that just makes her my favorite character. She seems much more realistic than any other character in the film.
Cool. What about you, Toby?
In a cast of mostly unrelatable people, I thought the best was actually Halliday. His appearance is very important, but not a lot of time is spent with him. But I think the brief moments we get are really, really good. And yeah, mm-hmm. I think he's the most relatable out of everyone.
To be honest, though, Sylvester Stallone was still better.
Oh, God. Mike, who's your favorite character?
Never letting that go. Sorry, Toby. My favorite character was also Artemis, for similar reasons than what Glenn was saying. I think she's less of the kind of annoying nerd trope than the other characters. Like, Parsifal mm-hmm. comes off at times a bit too comic book guy, if you know what I mean. Like, all right, cool it, dude. And I haven't mentioned it, but I really do kind of hate that there's an entire plot line that's just like, it turns out Halliday's greatest fear was kissing a girl. I'm like, oh, shut up. That's one line removed from, like, and this Star Trek fan lived in his mother's basement. Yeah. Leave me alone.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that point. I just like Halliday more in the broader sense than, like,
specific
dialogue.
I'm not judging you. I mean, he is well acted, and it is, like, he does get the kind of cool, the thrust of the film's plot, so to speak. But for me, like I said, Artemis was just less annoying with her nerdness. Like, she still had her passions and stuff. And to Glenn's point as well, she actually had the best plot. Like I said, you look at all the other characters, their motivation is like, I don't want adverts. And hers is actually a genuine, like, yo, you killed my dad, man. I'm going to get revenge.
Well, at the risk of sounding like a comic book guy, I'm going to have to go with Parsifal. Not Wade necessarily, but Parsifal, the alter ego. And yeah. I could wax reminiscent about how I love 80s pop culture and how I love playing, you know, on my old Atari, but it's basically going to come down to the dude's favourite movies, Buckaroo Banzai. So, yeah, I'm very shallow like that. So, favourite seed, and I'm going to... I'll jump in first, and I'll just say I'm going to go with either The Shining or that final battle where the orb's cancelled, everyone attacks, and Twisted Sister kicks in. I just love that little section. So, we'll go around in reverse order now. So what about you, Mike?
Similar to I would shout out the epic final battle, and that would probably be what I would go for. But a very close second for me would be the race at the start of the film. I just love that.
Cool. Toby?
I think... The race is probably my favorite action scene, and for non-action scenes, I would go to with not the end, but the end in the Oasis with Halliday and this room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The one where he sees young Halliday. Mm.
Yeah.
Cool. Where they basically hint that Halliday's like uploaded his consciousness into the Oasis, and mm-hmm. he's like a digital, like a living thing. Something.
He's the digital Tommy Westfall. Yeah, and exactly. Yeah, look that up, folks. What about you?
Please Glenn? Don't.
Hey, if I have to fall down that rabbit hole, I'm taking you what with me. So yeah, what about you, Glenn? What's your favourite scene?
The Shining and the race.
Nice.
Yeah, definitely.
Nice. And do you have a favourite line from this one?
I couldn't remember any actual line. I'm terrible. I'm absolutely atrocious at remembering lines from films or music. So I couldn't really, on the spot, think of one. There's nothing that really stands out. I think there's one swear word in the whole film, and it's one of the 101 guys, and it's the Chucky thing, And I think he just goes, fuck, it's Chucky.
Yeah.
And for me is, that just stands out because it's the only F-bomb in the whole film. So I think that stands out.
I'm going to jump in here and give you mine because otherwise it would seem a bit daft not to. But yeah, I've written down, swearing is not big and it's not clever, but it is occasionally hilarious. So my favourite line is also, it's fucking Chucky. My word, I laughed when that happened.
What about you, Toby?
Oh, no, lions. I hate lions. I can't remember any. Can I remember any lions?
Should I just stop asking people for favorite lines on this podcast?
I mean, you don't have to stop asking people. You have to stop asking me.
Toby's now exempt from any future lines.
Thank you.
I mean, we do ask, do you have any? I mean, I suppose no is a perfectly viable answer.
Yeah.
I hate every line. Please stop.
I was going to use that, you know, people come to the Oasis for all the things they can do, but they stay for all the things they can be. But I would be lying, and the one line I have written is, it's fucking Chucky.
Go on, Toby, say that was your favourite and we'll have a full house, 4 out of 4.
I just forgot.
Nice. Well, that's what we think so far, but what about you? We did the regular thing of asking you all on social media, and again, you lot didn't disappoint. So we're going to read as many of these out as we can, but bear in mind, we couldn't possibly get to them all. Yeah, once again, we had that many, so... we'll kick things off for you, Mike. What did your particular audience have to say?
Well, these are all from Facebook, because that tended to be the responses that we got were all from there. This is from the group Northeast Retro Den, or N-E-R-D, perfect acronym there. So this is from Jason Woodhead, who said, personally, I'd give it 3.5 out of 5. I know there was a lot of stuff from the book that didn't make it into the film and a fair bit that was changed, but overall it was an entertaining watch. Seeing that, I haven't felt the urge to re-watch it since I first saw it, and I'll happily watch films that I do enjoy over and over again. Fair enough. David Howland says, ticked a huge amount of nostalgia boxes and worth looking for all the homages. Basically a treasure hunt film, but I enjoyed it. Adam Gradwell said, I almost walked out of the cinema. The book is way better. No accounting for taste. Gary Slater said, what I will say is I'm glad I watched the movie before reading the book or I'd have been disappointed. I love the movie, don't get me wrong. I have tons of merch, vinyl record, collectors, 4K set, a glass golden egg, etc. But the book was so different and better. No accounting for taste. Stephen Vare says, one of my favorite movies, absolutely loved it and wish they would do a Ready Player 2. I have informed him they are doing it. He's a good friend of mine. Paul Clark says, absolutely loved it, loved the book, although bits were left out or changed. I don't think people fully grasp the enormity of bringing this to life. The sheer volume of nostalgia in the books is crazy, never mind all the licenses. Ghostbusters was left out, for example, due to no deal being struck with Sony. I thought Spielberg and the cast did terrific. Ross Hannon finally says, fun film. If anything, I think it could have leaned even heavier on retro music and visuals. I added this track to a scene that, in my opinion, was missing an opportunity, and he sent a link to the track Never Surrender by Lion, which he would have wanted. I don't know which scene it was referring to, but maybe work that out for yourselves. So, yeah.
Fair enough. I'll do you want me to take the Nerdy Up North ones?
Yeah, and then the Silver Screen we'll finish with.
All right, then. So we'll go to the Nerdy Up North group on Facebook. Jason Bowman says, it seemed completely real, a future that is coming true. People will live in stacked chicken coops, own and eat very little, but can log in and be heroic men, beautiful ladies, etc., despite who they are in real life. Meta is currently working on this. Kill it with fire. Fiona Hughes says, it's one of my favourites, probably one of the reasons my PhD topic is what it is. And you asked, ooh, what is it? And
I've completely forgotten who really should have written it down. She did. Yeah, she didn't respond for a little while, but then she did.
That really would have helped me on this section, Mike. Ian Burke says, I loved the first book, and I think the movie did a gear job. I presume maybe he's trying to say great job of capturing the feeling. It needed more of the music, though, I think. Second book is just the same story, but written in the style of an ethics lecture. I think Ready Player 3 might be delayed due to the author injuring his elbow while patting himself on the back repeatedly. I listened to the audiobook, so it felt like 12 hours of Will Wheaton telling me everything I'd loved was bad, even Prince, which hurts because I love Will Wheaton. I would do have to say, he hits that nail squarely on the head with that
good
one.
Lord, you're not convincing me to read this book.
I kind of wish he'd stuck with the first one. But, you know, your mileage may vary, audience, please. You know, no slanging. Bryony Campbell says it's one of my favourite films ever. Vince Smith says, I read the book, loved it. Seen the movie, loved it. They can never completely do what the books can. If they did, the movies would be 24 hours long. Brad Pinder says, I wish I saw the movie before I read the book. Spammer Jamie S. Jammer, which is just the all-star classic name. He says, I haven't read the book, but I thought the movie was good. It had his cheesy moments, but the end fight scene gets me every time. And then there's a little welling up emoji. Yoli Cabrera says, I read the book and watched the movie. I want to say the book is better, but the movie's still very well put together. So many references. Ben Hughes says, the young cast was excellent, but Ben Mendelsohn stole the show with his brilliant villain portrayal, as in Thursday. Also, Simon Pegg is always great. Favourite scene was the alien chestburster. Which brings us up to the Silver Screen Facebook group, and if you want to join in, folks, please do. Andrew Haunt says, I didn't really get on with the casting for Wade, but loved the film. Angela Grant, hello Angela, she says, I was annoyed by the lack... Oh God, I knew this was coming. I was annoyed by the lack of Rush references in the film when they're an integral part of the book. And if you know Angela...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Michael Whaley... go on, mate.
I was just going to say, to Angela, they didn't play the Fifth Element soundtrack anywhere in the actual film, so she must have been disappointed about that.
Yeah, I can imagine Angela walking out of the screen saying, fuck yep. that. Michael Whaley, who you will remember from our Ghostbusters review, he says he loves this film. And Jeff Tilley, he says, yeah, oh, man after my own heart, you have to reference the book author's love of the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. And nice. Then he provides a link to when Ernie Klein wrote an outline for a Buckaroo Banzai sequel. And if you want to see that, check out the Silver Screen Facebook group.
Awesome. I have a few more things here, by the way, if you've got finished. Yeah. I looked up Nerdy Up North Community so I can tell you what Fiona Hughes's PhD topic actually is.
Yeah, go for it.
She answered, finding out whether using VR in STEM education would naturally improve the retention and engagement of female students in secondary school. I genuinely feel dumb even reading that. I'm sure it's incredible, though.
I feel like I've now been educated with a banana and an inner tube.
Exactly.
Yeah, quite a fair amount. Suffice to say, this one generates a bit of discussion in general. So, as always, we did manage to read them out. So don't be discouraged. While we only have a limited amount of time, when we do get to read these feedbacks out, we do read each and every comment you send us, as you've just been evidenced by Mike replying to one. So please don't give up. And it goes for you. Want to have your say now. We're always open to reading what you've got to say, either in the comments section on the podcast itself or on our social medias. Isn't that right, Mike?
Within reason.
Do you want to direct the audience to where they can find us?
Oh, I'll have something on screen at any given time. Usually when I shout it out, you can find it if you're watching on YouTube. I've made a little graphic of where you can find us all the places online. As I say, I don't always go through it all because, you know, people are going to get bored of it. But you can find a link tree in the description, either on whichever audio site you're using or, again, on YouTube if you're watching this. The link tree will take you to all of our links, or 90% of the time, just look up either my name, Michael Wilson, or Silver Screen Podcast on whichever social media site you're on, and you'll find us.
Nice one. Cheers for that, fella. Yeah, those links will be in the description, so please drop us a line anytime. It's time to grab that final crystal key, open that final gate, and give our opinions and scores on this one. And if you're a regular, you'll know that each of our guests gives their score out of 5 and conclusions. As always, we'll start with our guests, and this time... Yeah, we'll come to you first, Toby. Final impressions on Ready Player One and a score out of 5, please. And are you all right to do the scoring on this, Mike?
Yeah.
Nice. So go for it, Toby.
Okay. Yeah, overall, this movie is nice to look at, but it's lacking of substance in a lot of ways. There are some good things. As I said, I mostly like what they did with Halliday. That's where we like. I mean, as I said, visually, it's really nice to look, and like the CGI, I think really looks good. I don't get people that say it doesn't hold up. It's a stylized choice. You have to get into that. If you can't get into that choice, fair enough. But like, it looks good. Yeah, but the characters are very flat. The hero journey is basic. The capitalism critique is technically there, I guess. Yeah,
adverts are bad.
Well, I like that one thing with the destroying of the races. So, you know, there's one thing about the critique that I actually liked, but the rest was technically there. Yeah, I gave it a. I don't know if I'd be the lowest of everyone, that and everyone's gonna hate me for it, but no. 2.5 out of 5.
No worries.
Still a full.
Nobody's screaming. Okay.
No. Nobody's like, you know, say get thee to a nunnery or anything. So I think you're all right on that one.
You're fine.
So yeah, Glenn. What about you?
It's a visually wonderful movie to look at. It moves at a really good pace. You don't find yourself thinking, please get to the next scene. It flows at a really good pace. There's plenty to look at. It's quite beautiful in places. It's just really entertaining. The Oasis segments stand out. The real life stuff is a little bit dull and flat, but it's a good film to just lose yourself in, and it does what it does. It doesn't really try to be too deep or too meaningful, and just gets the job done. It's an entertaining film, so it's a 3 out of 5.
Nice one, Mike.
I said way more accessible than the source novel, in my opinion, whilst retaining the sense of geeky fun and the feeling of nerd inclusiveness. But here, it's in an easy to digest adventure romp. It's the kind of thing Spielberg can direct in his sleep, so it goes without saying that, in my opinion, the direction is excellent. The acting has highlights, mainly the women, to be honest, but the cast are playing to this heightened fake reality, so it's hard to be too critical. It's amazing on a practical level how many IP the film was able to clear legally. I know such things are never easy, but the many Easter eggs are thematically appropriate and part of the fun, so you have to give them props for that. Likewise, the soundtrack is awesome, contributing to the overall retro geek feel. It's not perfect. I feel like you might have to be in the right kind of mood to enjoy it the most, and it does lose a bit of its initial sheen after multiple viewings. The leads are also way too Hollywood attractive to feel relatable, which is something the book gets right. There are some groan-worthy moments, a half-assed ending, and honestly not a ton of depth, but it's enjoyable, fun, looks great, speaks to pop culture fanatics like me, and still manages to play out an effectively engaging 2 and a bit hours that still gets me pumped, smiling, and ultimately satisfied. And I gave it 4 out of 5.
Fair enough. I was so not impressed when I first saw this, being one of those that expected a straight adaptation of Klein's book. But as I said right at the start of this, even disregarding the licensing issues, that would have been unwatchable. Looking at this now, viewing it as its own separate entity, I do actually like this one. There are some missteps, sure. Maybe some of the casting could have been a little, or maybe a lot better. Things that I personally wish had been included, and some things that, you know, aren't my personal cup of tea. But I'm more than happy with what we have. It mixes live action, CG animation well. It makes it a fun place to be, kind of like the Oasis itself. I will be going back to this one. And I also have given it a 4.
Hey, that's cool.
So, yeah, which means that after getting those scores together, Ready Player One ends with a silver screen score of Mike, my lovely assistant.
I'm going to round this up. It would be 3.4 out of 5. It's actually 3.375, but I'll round it up. 3.4 out of 5.
Fair enough. I think that's decent, especially with, you know, yeah, with it being so divisive in some corners. What do you guys think?
I think so.
I would say that's a fair score. Yeah.
I mean, if we see anything above 2.5 as a pass, 3.4 is pretty good.
Nice one. And that's it for this time around. We hope you out there have enjoyed this one as much as we've enjoyed creating this mess for you. All that's left to do now is thank my guests. So without further ado, Glenn, thank you for being on this one with us.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Nice one. Have you enjoyed yourself?
Oh, wonderful. I had an absolute blast. Thank you so much, guys. It has been incredibly entertaining after such an unfortunate false start with the microphone. I do apologise for that.
It's all right. We got there in the end.
I don't know what Mike did. I don't know what Mike did, but he did a damn good job.
He is our Scotty.
Whichever button he pushed the right one.
That's what they all say. anywhere the listeners can find you after this one? Is there any, you know, do you frequent social media or anything like that?
No, just Facebook, just normal Facebook. That's it. I'm not on anything else, just Facebook.
Cool. Do you want us to put your link down there for people to find you, or are you a bit of a hermit?
No, whichever. I'm glad. I'm happy to always to talk to fellow fans about anything.
Cool. Yeah, I'll get that for you, and we'll put it in there. So, Toby, thanks once again, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me again so shortly after the last one.
No worries, mate. It's always a pleasure. And how can the listeners find you? Anything you wanted to promote? Anything like that?
I think I can promote my Blue Sky account, Dark Sonic. You can find me for hot anime manga takes and nothing else because, I don't know, I don't like talking about anything else on Blue Sky because I have the Discord.
Nice. So again, we'll put that link in the description. And finally to you, Mike. Cheers for making it to this one, mate.
You're welcome, and apologies for being slightly post-con hyperactive. I promise I'll return to my depressive, laconic self in the next episode, audience.
No, I like it. Keep it. We need to send you out for exercise each weekend before the recordings.
Okay, well, look, if you're going to have Freema Agyem and hug me the day before every recording, I'm going to promise I'll be like that.
I'm not sure our agent will be able to swing it that much. you've already given our socials, so we know what's coming, so I'll just say see you soon.
Yeah, I mean, let me have a look. I think the schedule is up on here, so I think... Oh, yes, the very next one will be in 1 week's time. Yeah. And just very appropriately, let me just end, as we always do, by saying, in the epic words of Arnie, we'll be back.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the Silver Scream podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Scream Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.